This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You are listening to Earth Matters, and I'm Lee Chui Lin. Last week, Prime Minister Dato Sri Najib Razak launched the revised national policy on biological diversity, which has outlined five key principles in biodiversity management. Joining me now is Chi Yuk Ling, the Director of Programs at the Third World Network, to analyse the revised policies and to discuss whether these revisions will suffice to help fulfil Malaysia's obligations under the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity. Welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
Before we get into the revisions, let's talk about the National Policy on Biological Diversity, which was first implemented in 1998 to fulfill Malaysia's obligation under the UN Convention on Biological Diversity, or CBD as it's known. For some context, could you briefly tell us what this convention was about?
This convention is one of the three major conventions that was signed by members of the United Nations back in 1992. One was on biodiversity, and one on climate change, and the third one was on desertification and land degradation. And the CBD today remains the almost universal membership is involved around the world, except for the United States that has not signed on. So this is really a very comprehensive treaty. It's not just about environment, it's really about how we want to manage and use our resources sustainably for development.
Malaysia ratified the CBD in 1994. What are our obligations exactly?
Well, you know, the United Nations treaties are designed to really build the capacity, especially of developing countries, to meet the goals of the treaty. So the CBD actually has three major objectives. One is conservation. The second is sustainable use of biodiversity. And the third is, when we use biodiversity, how do we ensure there's fair and equitable benefit sharing between countries and also within the country? So under the CBD, Malaysia's obligations are really to make sure that we conserve, but not just in the preservation way, but how to conserve and use sustainably. And there are lots of also requirements, for example, to respect the knowledge and the rights of Indigenous peoples and local communities. These are among some of them, yeah.
When we talk about those five main principles, those key principles, what are they and how are they selected? I mean, assuming that biodiversity management is not something that is simple or that's linear.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that what is clearer compared to the first round of the 1998 policy is that the principles which are in the revised or new policy, I think it builds on the experience and knowledge gained over the last, 20, 30 years. So the five principles in the new policy are: one, heritage, that's recognising that biodiversity is a heritage of the entire society. Then there's a very important concept of precaution. In other words, when the science is not certain, for example, if you want to release genetically modified crops or seeds or mosquitoes into the environment, if the science is not certain on the impact, then we have to err on the side of caution. Why? Because if you disturb nature, the scale, and you cannot recall, like a defective car, you can recall, but not nature, sort of a species. So precaution is very important. It's very highlighted in this policy. Then shared responsibility. All of us in society have to take our responsibilities. Participation, I think, is very highlighted. And good governance in terms of how we want to manage in a transparent and accountable manner the management of our resources. So I think these are very five key principles.
And do these principles, were they not also present in the past? Why is it something that has been adjusted for?
Yeah. I think they were there. It's not that they are new. They were there. I think they're more explicit in the current principle. And, here I think we have more, there's an attempt in the new policy to sort of say, okay, here are the principles, and we go to goals, and we go to targets, and there's some indicators. So it tries to be a bit more precise than the former policy.
So before we start contrasting them, back to the first national policy, what were some of the main targets that were set out there?
Well, there were no specific targets, really. And I think there is criticism, that the new policy may even still be rather vague. I think it was really a policy statement, to be honest, I think it stayed mainly within the Ministry of Environment did not really fulfill the goals. And I think there was quite a lot of disappointment and criticism that the first policy did not go as far as it should have.
How does that first policy correlate with the National Environmental Policy of 2002, which sets out principles and strategies for Malaysia to exploit its natural resources in a sustainable way while also developing its economy?
Well, the National Environmental Policy and the National Biodiversity Policy are actually complementary, because in the National Environmental Policy, you also deal with what we call a lot of the brown issues, like pollution. You know, the green issues are the management of resources, the brown are like pollution, climate change. So there you also have like environmental impact assessments. So it really, I would say they're complementary. And the two policies, in theory, should be working together. And of course, the NRE, the Natural Resource and Natural Resources and Environment Ministry, is in charge, and they're supposed to coordinate also with other ministries and state governments. So these are national policies that are actually supplementary.
Coming back to that notion of the policy being rather vague, which is quite a funny thing to say about a policy, it's been said that the policy primarily did not set institutional obligations, delineation of various measures among institutions, timelines, implementation phases, monitoring and evaluation framework, and accountability provisions. Is that a fair statement? What are your thoughts?
You're talking
on this?
About the original 1998
yes,
policy.
That's right.
Yeah, to a large extent, I think that's a pretty fair statement. But, you know, on the other hand, a policy sometimes is really a big picture. And I think it attempted to be that at that time. But remember also back in 1998, the idea of mainstreaming conservation, natural resource management into actual actions in government planning was still something that was resisted. I'm not saying that resistance is gone today. And also because we have a system where the state actually is in control of land and forests. So you have to think about that federal-state relationship, which is quite sensitive. So getting the states to understand that they need to also do their part, especially like, you know, East Malaysia. I think Sarawak was one of the challenges in terms of management of forests, for example. Yeah.
Whose job would it have been at the time to translate this sort of, you know, wide-ranging policy into, you know, firm, actionable plans?
Well, the thing is, because, you know, there were two, I think a main impetus for the policy was, of course, the CBD. You know, those are international obligations that we have to comply with. Of course, if you don't comply in the UN, it's not that you will get a stick, you know, put on you. Because the idea, like I said, is to help countries to get to those goals. I think that the idea was, you know, although the focal point is NRE, back home, we really needed to get the issues of biodiversity use and conservation into like EPU and different ministries and state governments. I think that really didn't go far enough. Yeah.
Our Prime Minister launched the revised national policy on biological diversity last week. How pleased are you with the revised policy?
There was quite a fair amount of requests and consultation, you know, getting input from civil society. I mean, Third World Network, we were actually also involved in looking at some of the early drafts, and we gave our inputs and, you know, some ideas about more specific targets as well. I think compared to the first one, like I said, that it is more organized around goals and targets. But I would say it is an improvement, but it's still quite general. In some ways, you can't help having it to be general, but I think that the challenge will be, again, institutionally, how are we going to take this through? I mean, there are some mechanisms also proposed, but it's still, by 2025, you see many targets which says that, where we want to go, it's still rather vague, I would say, still rather vague.
What are some of those, you know, key targets that you think are perhaps more achievable than others, or that we should really be aiming for, to speak?
Well, I think, like I said, let me give you some examples, okay? There is a goal, number one, which is about empowering and harnessing the commitment of all stakeholders, right? And there's one target that by 2025, the contributions of Indigenous peoples and local communities, civil society, etc., to conservation and sustainable use will have increased significantly. Now, increased significantly, what does that mean? Where are we now? You know, so how do you measure that? I mean, there's some indicators, but there's kind of vague. But we also have some numbers, for example, for safeguarding our key ecosystems. I think a lot of people in the scientific community and conservation groups and many NGOs feel this too weak. It says that by 2025, there's a target, at least 20% of terrestrial or land areas and inland waters and 10% of coastal and marine areas should be conserved through a representative system of protected areas. Now, people are saying it's not about picking representation of certain ecosystems and then just protect that like a museum, right? And then, and the figure of 20% for terrestrial and 10% for coastal is too low if you think about managing holistically. So I think that's one of the targets. It's got numbers, but I think there is quite a good number of criticisms that the target is too low, and that it's looking at the goals of the policy in a very piecemeal manner rather than saying that it should be part of a bigger you know, resource management package. So what happens, you only have a few pockets that you have representative protection, and then the rest of it goes. And even if the pockets are there, they may be too small to be sustained. So from an environmental nature point of view, they may not even be able to last. So I think that will be something that we'll have a lot of discussion as we go forward.
As mentioned before, biodiversity is a very wide-ranging area. So when you hone in on these five goals, what would you say is kind of the overarching goal, if you will? You know, at the end of it all, should all these targets be met? Should all these goals be kind of achieved? What kind of Malaysia would we be looking at in 2025?
Well, I think that if we actually do meet, even we say that vague, but if we get these five goals out there, you know, in terms of not just, like I say, it is about conservation, sustainable use, and sharing of benefits. At the same time, you want to involve society in it. I would say by 2025, if we do it right, then we will actually, I think, also reduce consumption. I think people don't talk enough about that, because the demand side also will put pressure on how much resources you're going to exploit. So I think we have to live more green lifestyles, more sustainably. We have to also look at the way we are urbanizing. We can't keep having our cities grow bigger and more cars and more roads. That's a contradiction to this policy. And I think that more say, more transparency is very important, because I think one of the biggest challenges in Malaysia is how are timber licenses, how are mining licenses given. And I think the transparency, good governance part, if we can get there, I think there will be it'll be a big achievement. But it's going to be full of, you know, challenges. I don't think it's going to be easy, obviously. We need to get state governments to come on board. We need to rise above the sort of political, you know, the party politics, so we don't punish, you know, opposition states, for example, by not sort of working with them more closely to get resources, to get income for the state, but also to manage sustainably. So I think we need to really get the bigger goals as part of our political framing, rather than the sort of petty politics of federal state sort of, you know, fight over jurisdiction.
Is 10 years a realistic goal?
You know, I would say that, you know, we have not met a lot of the hopes of the first policy. So if you think about 10, 15 years, I think it's not enough. We also have at the international level this Aichi targets, you know, which were adopted in Japan a few years ago. And that is part of what has been integrated into our national policy. Now, that one is 2011 to 2020. Again, you know, these are very short time frames. But I think 10 years is not long enough, but it's a workable period.
Are the short time frames present, you know, to imbue a sense of urgency to the proceedings? Or is it, because I wonder, you know, I think it's nice to have these catchy numbers,
yes,
you know, and,
yes,
and if you look at the measures that are being put in place, not just here, but worldwide, you know, the idea of how many degrees do we need to list,
right,
and so on. It's nice to have a simple number that people can remember. And, you know, Wawasan Duplo-Duplo, for instance,
right.
is a key
right.
example of that.
Right.
So why are we picking such short time frames?
Well, I think that, you know, the time frames is because you also, on the one hand, you need time frames to sort of go towards the target. But some of these things take quite a long time to go. One of the fundamental things when it comes to managing resources well and sustainably is attitude, values, and mindset. And that is a long-term process. But if we leave it too vague, then there's no accountability about getting to a certain goal as well. So I think it's not easy. I mean, if I were on the government side trying to be more specific and not deliver, you get into trouble. And you kind of buy in, you don't have a bigger buy-in from different players. On the other hand, but I think urgency is lacking. We do not have a sense of urgency. Once in a while, we read something about, you know, this species got extinct, that is extinct. But so we don't really, in Malaysia and in most countries, have that sense of urgency yet. And I think we need to have a lot of awareness building on that front.
I'm speaking today with Chee Yuk Ling, Director of Programs at Third World Network. Up next, we discuss accountability inside of the revised national policy on biological diversity, which was announced last week. You are listening today to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You're listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture with me, Lee Chui Lin, as well as Chee Yuk Ling today, Director of Programs at Third World Network. And we're analysing the revised national policy on biological diversity today. So we've established kind of what its five main goals are, and then subsequently under that, the different targets. How does this policy correspond with the environmental protection measures set out in the 11th Malaysia Plan, which actually emphasised climate change and adaptation, biodiversity, renewable energy, and cutting carbon emissions?
Yeah. Well, you know, the 11th Malaysia Plan actually, as you have just described, has all those different areas which are all part of the big piece of how we're going to deal with the planet and our little piece called Malaysia. So the biodiversity policy is part of trying to implement that plan. So there is a certain logic that makes sense. So I would say that the challenge is really, like for example, on climate change, we have submitted as Malaysia a national contribution, what we would do under the new Paris Agreement, you know, in the period after 2020 when that agreement comes into force. And part of that submission of Malaysia's sort of pledge includes the forest conservation and protection, so that our emissions from forests will be, you know, like zero emissions, as we say, you know, at a certain target point. So that has to then jive with the biodiversity policy, which there are multiple reasons why we need to protect biodiversity, of, you know, and so I think these policies are complementary.
Well, we're looking at it on a policy level, mm-hmm. on plans, you know, taking into account international agreements. Mm-hmm. We can't, or perhaps shouldn't, sidestep the issue of the TPP, mm-hmm. which has been causing much, what's the word for it, discussion. I think that's the kindest word. Yes. Much discussion here in mm-hmm. our country. Mm-hmm. How would the TPP affect our national policies mm-hmm. on biological diversity?
Right. I think one of the concerns about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement is that that kind of agreement is really at its heart about opening up a country's economy to more movement of foreign investors. It's more economic sort of exploitation, if you want to call it that, right? Now, of course, there are chapters in the TPP, one on environment and one on development, and it sort of has the sort of general statements that we must respect our environmental treaties like the CBD. But if you look at the heart of what the TPP is, right, out of the 30 chapters, there are 6 on goods, the rest are all about regulation and policy. So one, I think the concern is that because it is about pushing trade and investment, that economic pillar may actually not be balanced by an environmental pillar. Now, what does it mean in real terms? For the other chapters, which is all about regulation and policy, it actually... So what we do, for example, in our conservation, biodiversity policy, environmental policy, climate change policy, all these policies require the government to have regulations, laws. Even making a policy, you are going to restrict the rights of certain actors and players and the privileges. So you may want to control what investors are allowed to do. You may want to say that if I give you a license to come and do something in Malaysia and you have to comply with my environmental laws and my biodiversity policy, if you violate that, I will terminate your license, for example. Now, under the TPP, in some ways you can do it, but that right to regulate, let's say, biodiversity protection is also subject to an investment chapter. And in an investment chapter, the broad rights of the investor that's been given allows an investor to sue a government for actually taking away their profit or even anticipated potential future profit. This, we are worried, will have a clash with, let's say, our biodiversity policy if we actually take strong actions that affects the interests of an investor. So the TPP, in that sense, actually has to be really carefully looked at. We haven't ratified it yet legally, so we have to look at how all our policies, including the biodiversity policy, will be protected or may be contradicted by some of the TPP provisions.
And you can do that by looking at hypothetical situations, sort of running through different ideas of what might happen. I mean, how can we anticipate, even in the best drawn sort of legal documents. People find loopholes.
Right.
You know, there are moments of exploitation.
I think one of the actually bigger challenges, really, this is a beginning, it's been growing in international debate. You see, we have the CBD, we have climate change, we have a so-called new agreement now, the Paris Agreement, about, you know, implementing more climate actions because urgency is really being felt, you know, at least on the climate front, people are beginning to understand that. But we also have the old trade and investment rules, like in the World Trade Organization. I'll give a very quick example. Right, just Wednesday this week, now the United States took India to a WTO dispute, the World Trade Organization. There they were saying that the Indian government has a huge solar sort of mission policy. So for a country over the last few years, from going zero renewable in solar energy, they have really made amazing increases. So, and that's part of their policy that they're implementing. Now, part of that policy says that any supplier to solar panel to power generation in India or for solar energy, you, if you're a foreign company, you must buy part of your local content from Indian companies. Now, that actually is to build up the Indian industry itself in this sector and also to create employment. It's called domestic content, right? Now, the United States took India to the World Trade Organization to say this is illegal because you are breaking a number of rules on subsidies and this and that within the WTO. And the WTO dispute panel on Wednesday this week found that they decided that India is in violation and this is illegal, so they have to stop doing that. Now, the same solar mission or same project was celebrated in an India-US sort of bilateral sort of statement in Paris during the climate negotiation, where Obama said, we are so happy to see India taking these very big steps on solar energy and renewable energy. Now, so what we have here is a case, and we have those same rules and restrictions on local content in the TPP. All right. So these so-called trade and agreements that actually cut into the power and regulatory space of countries to do the right thing in the environment front, it's a problem. So this is a good case to illustrate that we need to change the trade agreements, to give priority to our climate and biodiversity policies and laws.
Once those policies go into action, mm-hmm. once you actually start enforcing, are there enough monitoring mechanisms, targets, timelines built into the plan, enough to keep people accountable, mm-hmm. enough to keep people on point?
Yeah. Well, the policy is only the first step, yeah, because we have a lot of existing laws. We also have the issue of enforcement, and I think this is nothing new. We all have been complaining, I think, and worried that the enforcement on environmental laws, etc., are not strong as it should be. For example, recently in Pahang with the bauxite pollution, right? Everybody knew this was over mining. They shouldn't be mining during that period, but it was happening, right? So then finally we had a disaster, then the government suspends the operation of the mine for 3 months. So we don't want to wait to that situation where the environment could be destroyed to a no return point. So this, like I said, this is a policy. Now, within the policy, it says it's going to set up a national steering committee, state steering committee. We're always setting up a lot of committees. And we have existing committees. They hardly meet. If they meet, they are not really going into action. So I think we need a lot of coordination. We also need to have enforcement. And these are familiar problems that we have not seen, implemented in many of our current environmental laws. So that challenge continues.
With the revisions, though, does it address the gaps that hindered real implementations of the previous policy? Does it do it sufficiently?
I would say no. I think that what we need to overcome in terms of lack of coordination, like enforcement, is a wider issue. The policy alone is not going to solve it. I think the policy's success will also be dependent on unraveling those obstacles.
Does the revised policy contain clear and achievable national targets?
We went through some of them. Some of them are by their nature rather kind of vague, yeah, like significant increase, or you have, for example, more Malaysians will be aware by 2025, of the values of biodiversity. I mean, those are, in a way, they are wish list. They are very general. It's good to have them, but how are you going to do it? Of course, then you go into the policy, they talk about education, et cetera, et cetera. Again, I don't think any of the actions are really new. If we have implemented a lot of the existing policies and laws, we would be really halfway there already.
So yeah. I guess what we have mm-hmm. is a blend of the highly specific mm-hmm. and then the slightly vague within the policy.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a proper monitoring and evaluation structure that identifies ways towards mobilizing financial resources that would enable implementation?
Yes, there is a section, there is a sort of a part that looks at mobilizing finance and also innovative ways of looking at finance. I think if you look at really financing biodiversity conservation and use, the use part is also about research, so it's not just about conservation. Like, I think we have to keep remembering it's about how do we sustainably use our biodiversity. So again, if we go back to our own national budget, how much of our national budget goes towards environmental protection, how much goes into really supporting the right kind of research so that we can get value added to our biodiversity, potential. There's no major change if you go back and look at budgets, for example. In fact, now with a lot of financial problems, budgets are being cut back. So when budgets have been cut back, it's in health, in environment that we will see the sort of victims, So I don't see at the moment, although the policy talks about mobilizing more, it actually introduces the idea that the government can't fund everything. Therefore, we must look to the private sector. And I think trying to rely on the private sector to give you money is not necessarily the best way because a lot of companies are themselves problems, They might be like you have our foreign companies. We have documented several cases within TWN of foreign researchers and companies coming to countries like Malaysia, other developing countries rich in biodiversity. They've taken our plants or seeds, or they've tapped into the knowledge of our people who know how to use these resources, and then they do some little tinkering, and then they put a patent on it for 20 years, and then they sell it back to us at high cost, and they don't share the benefit that they have actually gain from using our resources. So benefit sharing is a very big part of it. Now, all this means that we must also have rules that regulate the private sector and some companies. If you rely on the private sector to just invest in biodiversity conservation, we're not there at the moment. So I think some of us have concerns that too much emphasis on saying we look outside of public funding and then therefore do not increase public funding, that may not be the right way to go. So we need a good balance. And I think the role of the public sector or public financing and budget allocation still is quite important.
Ultimately, how will the success of the policy be measured?
In 2025, we could have another interview. I would say in terms of, okay, you can measure the success because there are targets, there are indicators. I think the government, to be fair, is trying, right, to put in indicators to say, well, at least we can look at those indicators to see whether we're getting there or not. Indicators require you to have good data. So, I mean, we joke about it, but seriously, we still have conflicting numbers of what is the actual scale of forest coverage in Malaysia. How do you define forest? I mean, we had a period where we defined forest as tree cover as well. So every tree outside this window is also part of forest, right? And that's not, from the biodiversity point of view, that's not the case. But I think one of the areas, though, of diversity that we should overlook in Malaysia a lot is in the area of seeds in agriculture. We, small farmers are, in a way, a very threatened species in this country. And with small farmers, are a lot of very precious local varieties of seeds. So that's an area I think that needs more attention. It's not just about wildlife. It's also about seeds.
In the next 10 years, are we going to have regular checkpoints at which we sit down and look at how far we've come and say, okay, what else needs to be done?
I think that this will be, the whole idea, and this is a repeated yet again in this policy, about mainstreaming biodiversity and sustainable use into all development policy, so that in the end we are moving towards sustainable development, right? We say that in the rhetorical way. So it means that we will have to look at the midterm review of, let's say, 11th Malaysia Plan, all right? We have to look at all the different instruments that is looking at milestones and measuring of our development progress. And within all that, you must include the biodiversity policy as part of that package. Otherwise, it's going to be siloed and marginalised. So those will be how you need to measure. And of course, there are some institutional ideas about different kinds of committees and all that. So those committees must meet under the state and federal level and then set more specific targets, because we need to have a work plan, an actual work plan that needs to be worked out under this policy.
The PM admitted that development through the opening of land for agriculture, human settlement, industrialization, and transport has had significant impact on the natural environment. Do you sense more political will behind the rhetoric and revised policies?
This is not just our Prime Minister, but every politician. When you are actually in a forum or you are actually writing and thinking about, let's say, a biodiversity policy, then that thought comes to your head. Okay, then you go, let's say, tomorrow to something which is more about boosting economic growth and trade. And then we'll talk about how Malaysia must increase its competitiveness, export more. And then a lot of those thinking, right, will actually undermine the thinking yesterday about biodiversity. So there are lots of dilemmas and contradictions. And I think that he's not wrong. I think he believes what he said when he launched the biodiversity policy. But we also have conflicting policies in other sectors. So that is, I think, the bigger challenge. And I would like to see if the biodiversity policy can trigger thinking and rethinking of our economic trade, finance policies. And that would be, I think, a wish list for many of us.
Finally, as you say, a wish list for many of us, but for the general public, why should people care about such policies? It can often feel like kind of highfalutin ideas just flying around without any real impact to my daily life.
Well, I think a lot of people feel the thing about this policy, again, it places biodiversity not just as a sort of, out there science idea of diversity of species, but that biodiversity, to sustain diversity, you need ecosystems, right? You need your environment to, it's all part of our world, our physical world. And I think that people sometimes don't realize the impact of biodiversity loss. So a lot of education, I think, is needed. People have to realize that if we want to be able to enjoy, new medicines, for example, then we have to protect diversity, because from nature we will have, active ingredients that potentially could be discovered. And I think a lot of people know it. For example, I hear so often, and I myself say, I go to the market, I cannot find the variety of bananas that we had when we were growing up. Some of my kids have never seen, some of the fruits that we saw as we were growing up. And then when you take kids on a holiday into the countryside, into orchards, they get so excited, right? So there's something about us that respond to diversity in nature, but we don't link it to our head and intellectually about what it means. It's just not there accidentally, or it just stays there because it's there, that there are forces at work that I can protect it, use it wisely, or destroy it. So I think people... Yeah, there's still a lot of education and awareness that's needed.
Thank you very much for coming in. On that note, I've been speaking with Chee Yuk Ling today, Director of Programs at Third World Network. We've been talking about the revisions or the revised national policy on biological diversity. You've been listening today to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.